place set for oral argument in State of Idaho versus John Doe, dockets number 47401 and 47402. On behalf of Mr. Doe, we have Mr. Fisher, and on behalf of the state, we have Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Fisher, are you prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I want to start by letting the court and counsel know that what this isn't, and what I'm not arguing, and what my client isn't arguing or trying to say. Nothing that I argue or talk about should be construed as an attempt to minimize the crimes that my client is alleged to have committed. There's no question in briefing or otherwise that the charged offenses are serious. There's no dispute about that. But I think always when we're addressing legal and factual issues, we obviously will always seek to distinguish and differentiate between different offenses that may be worse or less severe. And that's particularly important in this case because we have a client who the state has sought to charge him and prosecute him and punish him as an adult when I believe that objectively that the evidence as viewed underneath the standards set out in the statutes that have been cited for waiver, that the evidence suggests that this isn't a case where my client should be waived. I don't want to rehash or go through everything. I know you've had the opportunity to read. I've written a lot and put a lot of effort into making as clear as possible my position. I want to just highlight a few things that I think are important. One of the things that the district court didn't address, which I'm asking this court to address, is that I take issue with the interpretation of the statute that the magistrate applied. And so while the magistrate had discretion in deciding whether to waive my client, part of that discretion involves making sure that the law is applied correctly and that the law is interpreted correctly. My position is that as the magistrate interpreted the law, that it allowed for that it was inadequate, that it allowed for consideration of elements that shouldn't have been. And the largest issue, the biggest issue that I have is the first subsection. Well, let me just, the issue of, I guess one of the biggest issues I have is with regard to the issue of whether my client should be incarcerated, whether it's necessary to isolate him for the protection of the community in an adult facility versus in a juvenile facility. I think this is one of the major things that was not really seriously considered. The evidence was really undisputed that the juvenile facilities are adequate, that everything that would be needed for this type of offender, for these types of offenses, would be provided in the juvenile setting.
Mr. Fisher, yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I guess I'm unclear when you say that the evidence was undisputed. In fact, didn't the two probation officers who suggested waiver explain that they did not think there would be sufficient treatment in a juvenile facility because of the length of time? The defendant was 17 at the time, and they testified that lots of individuals are released at 18, and that given the level of treatment that he would need and his resistance to treatment, that he would require treatment for longer than he could be in the juvenile facility?
The probation officers, I think that they did try to say that that essentially in a nutshell that they didn't think there was going to be enough time. My recollection of their testimony, particularly I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but the one of them had been doing this for about a year and a half. And I think my sense was that it was more of a talking point and more of a, hey, we just don't think that they're going to do enough. But that wasn't, I don't know that he had any foundation or any basis to talk about that in any meaningful way. And so whether it was disputed or undisputed, I think any undisputed piece lacked any foundation. I mean, we have those that actually know in the DJC and even the psychosexual evaluator, you know, they all said that treatment in a secure, but in a juvenile secure facility was what he needed. And so I think that the judge's ruling about the need to prolong it, I mean, I don't know what else to call it, but just speculation or concern that really isn't based on facts. I mean, I think the probation officers, to the extent that they expressed concerns about the length of time, I think that they were more conclusory than actual factual testimony or testimony with any expertise or specialized knowledge. They clearly didn't have knowledge about the programs, at least sufficient to, or to the extent that the DJC person did. And so I would just suggest that really the objective evidence is that they had adequate facilities. And I know, I don't think either judge, but magistrate didn't address that or compare that really at all, to my recollection, didn't really compare here's what is available in the juvenile setting versus here's what's available in the adult setting. And I think that was one of the major problems. Focusing.
Wasn't there testimony on that distinction? For example, they compared the kinds of programming that would be available in the adult facilities as compared to the type and length of programming in the juvenile facilities. So could you point me somewhere in the record where there was not, am I misunderstanding what the record contains?
I don't think so. I will acknowledge that, and I think it was the DJC person mostly who addressed that, because he elaborated on what was available and the time frame and all that. And then the adult probation person addressed the issue of, you know, kind of what happens in the adult setting. And I guess, you know, he said that you go and you're incarcerated and at the tail end, you receive some treatment. And so, yes, I think that there was evidence about what was available, more so in the juvenile setting. I guess my concern is, I don't know that the court really addressed or didn't address the issue of why do we need to, I guess my take on this statute is that we starting from a place of, we're going to leave this person as a juvenile if at all possible. And I think that's the legislative intent and policy. We're going to do that. And so if we're going to deviate from that, there ought to be a good reason and there ought to be some evidence. Some of the cases that were cited, there was, and I put this in the brief, but there was actual testimony about the need to continue treatment beyond the 21 years. And in this case, that wasn't the case at all. So while there may be some talk about, you know, hey, we think that this is needed, I this case differs from those other cases, Doe and the others, in that in this case, unlike those, there was no actual evidence from the psychologist, the psychosexual evaluator, regarding the need for an extended period of treatment. And I think that's critical. I think that without that, you're getting into and making decisions about a person's need for specialized treatment based on lay testimony of that's really inadequate. So if in this case the evaluator had said something to the effect that, yeah, we think it needs to be beyond that, I think this would be a very different case. And that's another point I wanted to make. I mentioned it in the brief, but the district court had, I think, incorrectly assumed or cited that there was some opinion evidence in this case that was needed. And I wanted to point out that that's not the case, that the evaluator did not make that recommendation. And so I think that's a huge error that really would affect the analysis in this case.
Mr. Fisher, I guess could you help me understand what the argument is in that regard?
Well, so I think if we had evidence, so I think that the district court based its decision in part on the belief that there was evidence in this case that from the psychosexual evaluator that he had expressed the opinion that my client needed to be treated beyond his 21st birthday. And if that was true, and there's actually one of the cases we cited that was the case in that appellate case where in that case, I think it was Dr. Beaver had opined that the defendant in that case needed to be treated beyond the 21st birthday. And so I think there may have been some confusion, but in this case, there was no evidence of that. That was never expressed. And so the fact that was, I think, a part of the reason why the district court found that it was appropriate that this factor weighed in favor of waiver. But without that, that was just one other piece, a huge piece, I think, of evidence that just isn't in favor of waiver because it doesn't exist. And so there was no direct evidence, no opinion evidence about the need to continue beyond the juvenile court's jurisdiction of 21 years.
Thank you.
And I think I want to point out again, I think one of the most important aspects of this appeal is that when I read Idaho Code 20-501, and I look at the legislative intent in the Juvenile Corrections Act about it's the policy of the state, and in my own words, to treat juveniles as juveniles to the extent that it's possible, and that accountability, community protection, and competency development are emphasized repeatedly. And in this particular case, I think that objectively, the evidence points in that direction, this isn't the type of case that ought to be treated as a juvenile. If my client had procured, was active in producing or developing, or it was in some way involved other than in a passive way, I could understand the state's insistence on proceeding in this way. But I don't think that we should equate, you know, my client using apps on his phone to hide this behavior, which I don't think we should treat that the same way and treat that as the type of intent or, you know, bad action as somebody who actually creates that. I mean, it's all heinous, right? But to treat someone as an adult in this particular circumstance, I don't know whether it would have happened anywhere else. The only thing I can say is with regard to that is that the DJC witness testified that a person like Nick, this is precisely the type of people they take over at St. Anthony, a person who's about his age, a person who's got the same types of offenses, and that it works. And the state has given the Department of Juvenile Corrections the authority and the responsibility of treating and handling people like this. And so to the extent that there's any wiggle room, if you will, or that I think everything should be construed in favor of trying to keep this kid as a kid and to treat his behavior appropriately within that setting. And I think that it would be adequate. And if the lower courts had looked at it in that way and limited their focus, their inquiry, their analysis to the scope of the individual elements of the statute, I think that they would have come to the same conclusion. And so, again, this is broad, but there were several issues that I addressed that I think that the statute was interpreted incorrectly. And if it was interpreted the way that I think it should be with just the plain reading of the statute, that we would have had a different outcome. So I'm asking the court to review de novo the interpretation, make sure that it's accurate, and then to apply the other standards of review. And at the end of this, I think that the appropriate outcome is, again, to treat this juvenile as a juvenile and to, you know, allow him to be treated in the facility where that is adequate, and to focus on the one factor that the statute 20501, the legislative intent, that statute emphasizes, and which the magistrate didn't emphasize or determined to be pretty much insignificant, and that's the competency development component. The magistrate pretty much said, I think he's, you know, okay, it's if it wasn't for his criminality. But as I said in my brief, that's precisely the issue. I think that they're not separate. I think the fact that he's engaging in this and immature and other wrongful behaviors is precisely why we should focus more on the competency development, and that factor should weigh in favor of not waiving. And so I think at the end of this, if the court does that, interprets the statutes correctly, and applies it under the appropriate standards of review, that waiver isn't the right decision. And so I just ask you to—
Mr. Fisher?
Yes.
Is your argument regarding the competency factor a statutory argument or an argument based on the evidence?
Well, I think it's both. That factor, the magistrate said, was essentially not an issue. He didn't find it to be helpful because he said, well, I think that Nick has sufficient competency and life skills. It's just that he's choosing to be criminal. And so I think that there's plenty of evidence that in the record that he really does need the competency and development. And that's why we asked for, and the judge obviously allowed him to have his psychosexual evaluation and the recommended, and there's treatment recommended for that, which is needed, which I think falls under that. There's the alcohol and drug component, which falls under that, I believe. And then there's the education and everything else, I think, that falls under that. And I think the evidence strongly suggests that he's amenable to that, that he's amenable to treatment. And significantly, there's this distinction, I think, between when he's out of custody and custody, because a lot of the testimony and a lot of the complaint was that when he gets out of custody, he screws up. Well, that's true. But we're not asking for him to be out of custody. We want him to be in custody so that he can get that competency and to be rehabilitated. And the undisputed evidence is that, and I think I can say this fully, he really is undisputed, that while he's been in custody, he's actually a model detainee. I mean, he doesn't get in trouble. He levels up. He gets extra privileges, and he's helpful to others. And so having him in that setting, I think, is appropriate. It's never been tried. He's never been committed to DJC because his history is so short. And so again, that would be the first thing is, well, let's put him in DJC custody, let it treat him as a juvenile, and trust that the legislature knew what they were doing when they gave them authority to handle these things. And then if it doesn't, I mean, if it's not good enough, he's going to have problems later, and then he'll be treated as an adult. But I think the assumption should be that he can succeed because he's showing that he can while incarcerated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Jorgensen, the state's response.
Thank you. Before this court is a juvenile waiver. The magistrate concluded that the waiver was appropriate and that the juvenile should be addressed through the adult criminal justice system. The district court on intermediate appeal affirmed that decision, and before this court is the question of whether the district court properly affirmed the magistrate's exercise of discretion. The district court did, because the magistrate did appropriately exercise its discretion. Its discretion is controlled by Section 2508 of the Idaho Code, the Juvenile Corrections Act, and that provides that there should be 6 specific factors considered in the waiver decision. It does not appear that those 6 factors are necessarily exclusive, but they must be considered. The record is clear that the magistrate did consider all 6 factors, did make factual findings in relation to all 6 factors, and then weighed all 6 factors in its discretion. The primary argument that's been made today has related to that first factor. That first factor is the seriousness of the offense and whether the protection of the community requires isolation of the juvenile beyond that afforded by the juvenile facilities. What the magistrate concluded was that it was likely that Doe could complete the rehabilitative program, the programming in the juvenile correction system in between six months and two years. So he would complete the programming. What the magistrate specifically concluded that was insufficient to protect the community was the ability to monitor Doe after the completion of that programming. In other words, it's basically the concern of probation in the juvenile system versus parole in the adult system. And which of those two things was going to better protect the community through isolation or potential isolation of this particular individual. And the magistrate concluded that the amount of time left for that probationary period following the treatment was just inadequate. If it ended on his 21st birthday. Basically, society needed a longer tail on this particular individual in order to make sure that the treatment had been effective and that the behaviors had actually changed. Because if those behaviors hadn't changed and the treatment wasn't effective, society wouldn't be protected. And on the 21st birthday of this particular juvenile, society would be again at risk. That is a perfectly logical decision supported by the evidence and consistent with the legal standard. And therefore, there's been no showing that particular prong was misjudged by the magistrate, either legally or factually, and therefore there's been no showing of any abuse of discretion.
Mr. Jorgensen, what is the state's interpretation regarding factor F, the one that opposing counsel spoke last regarding the competency, how that factor relates to waiver and, I guess, placement in the adult system or the juvenile system?
Factor F reads, the likelihood that the juvenile will develop competency and life skills to become a contributing member to the community by use of facilities and resources available to the court. So as I look at that, that's kind of a rehabilitative, but it's only one component of rehabilitation. It's whether a juvenile who generally lacks life skills. In other words, most juveniles come into the juvenile court unable to function as adults. They are still legally obliged to live with their parents. Their parents are still legally obliged to provide the necessities of life for them. So the question is one of rehabilitation and whether that individual is going to be able to develop independence from their families and that sort of thing. And I think that goes to something that's a little broader as well, in that in any sentencing system, we're concerned about the company one keeps, so to speak. One of the greatest indicators of rehabilitation or recidivism is going to be the associations that one makes. So the juvenile's ability to make that transition from being in a juvenile to an adult is an important component of rehabilitation. Now, the way the magistrate looked at that was, this kid's 17 years old. He's mostly already done that. There's very little additional that this court can do to teach him how to be an adult in terms of becoming independent. He's already taken that step. He's already out of school. He's already got a job. He's doing all of those things that we would expect of a 17-year-old in preparation for that transition. And so there's very little that the juvenile system can do to facilitate that as a rehabilitative measure.
So as you read that factor, it's what resources are available in the juvenile system, because that's not what it says. It says the facilities and resources available to the court. So I'm trying to figure out, I mean, I don't read this as stating a preference for the juvenile system versus the adult system. And I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out in terms of resources available to the court and how that factors into the analysis.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It doesn't specify the juvenile system, and it would also include the adult system and the comparison in that. Obviously, in adult court, we are also concerned with these factors. We are concerned with getting adequate housing. We are concerned with getting employment. So there are those sorts of resources. They are, I think, slightly different in the sense that the juvenile system is trying to gear somebody up in order to make that transition from a controlled home environment where adults are legally required to provide this sort of thing to a juvenile, to an adult where they're responsible on their own to provide these things for themselves. So in this particular case, there was really nothing that I saw in the record that would indicate that Doe was a particular risk for things like homelessness, a particular risk for things like chronic unemployment, those sorts of things. He was showing signs that he could do those things. And so the adult system wouldn't really have to intervene in that step. But then again, the juvenile system probably didn't have a lot to do in that step either. And I think that's why the magistrate considered that more or less a more neutral factor. I would like to just address one particular thing, and that is the maturity. Of course, we have a difference between the lower courts on the maturity factor. And the magistrate, of course, found that Doe was more mature than his age. He showed a maturity that seemed to be above average, whereas the district court said, no, the evidence shows below average. And I would just suggest that the district court didn't give the proper deference to the magistrate's factual findings in that regard. There is certainly conflicting evidence in this record as to the maturity level. But ultimately, what I'm concerned about is that the district court seemed to be very, very focused on a relative as opposed to an absolute form of maturity. The magistrate did say mature for his age, but really this is more of an absolute level of maturity. An immature 17-year-old versus a mature 12-year-old, we're still talking about very different individuals, and it seems kind of silly that a 12-year-old who's as mature as a 14-year-old would weigh more in favor as opposed to a 17-year-old who maybe is, shows the maturity of a 16-year-old. So I would suggest that the district court did not apply the right standard there, that the magistrate's findings are supported, and that all of the factors that the magistrate found are present. And then the weighing is a matter of discretion, and the magistrate did not abuse its discretion in the weighing. And therefore, the state would request that this court affirm, ultimately, the district court appellate ruling, which affirms the magistrate ruling.
Mr. Jorgensen, could you address the burden of proof argument raised by Doe in his briefing?
Certainly, Your Honor. And the first thing I would point out is that the record just simply does not support the idea that the trial court, the magistrate, misapplied any burden of proof. And I think that that's shown by two things. First off, the magistrate doesn't discuss at all the idea of probable cause until after it's granted the petition. So it grants the petition first, And then it says, and I find probable cause. So there's no indication there that the district court was saying probable cause is the right standard. Second off, as you read the magistrate's actual factual findings, the magistrate at no point indicates that it's doing anything on less than a preponderance of the evidence. It keeps using phrases that would indicate a high degree of proof in relation to its factual findings. It talks about things like, okay, I'm going to admit my age here. It's talking about things like, there is no question that Mr. Cates asked with regard to possession of the sexually exploited material. It is irrational to conclude that this offense was not against persons. Certain things were clearly demonstrated. He was clearly able. It's clear. Findings. The effort was not successful. Screams at this court. I mean, there's all sorts of language that the magistrate employs that is absolutely inconsistent with the idea that he's only finding the possibility, a reasonable possibility of these things, as opposed to finding them proved either by clear and convincing evidence or by a preponderance of evidence, that it's more likely than not. So ultimately, the magistrate does talk about probable cause, but the way it discusses probable cause does not indicate that it found only probable cause that waiver was a good idea or was legally appropriate here. The record does show that the magistrate went through the factors, went through its factual findings, treated it as an evidentiary hearing and applied the standards of an evidentiary hearing, not a probable cause hearing, and ultimately made this waiver decision and then added the probable cause on top of that. And the Smith case, which is probably the one the magistrate had in mind when it was talking about probable cause and expressing some confusion about whether what it's doing is even necessary, which is, by the way, another indication that the magistrate was not applying probable cause, because the magistrate specifically said on the record, I'm not even sure that I need to do this. But the Smith case said, you know, probable cause probably plays some role in all of this, just simply because we have an accusation that hasn't been proven yet. We have a criminal charge, and therefore probable cause to believe that Doe in fact did what the state accuses him of doing is probably going to be included in this analysis, especially on factors such as the seriousness of the crime and that sort of thing. So ultimately, this record does not support the idea that the magistrate applied anything other than a preponderance or greater standard to its factual findings.
Thank you.
Because Doe has failed to show any error by the lower courts, the state does request that this court affirm the waiver.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Fisher, any reply?
Yes, thank you. Just briefly, I wanted to address factor F of 2508. And I think that to read the paragraph, I'm sorry, Idaho Code 20508, section 8, that's where the factors are contained. And factor F was asked about, and the way that I read this statute is that it applies to what the juvenile court has available to it. Because paragraph 8 or section 8 says, in considering whether or not to waive juvenile court jurisdiction over the juvenile court shall consider the following factors. And so this whole section is addressed to the juvenile court, not judge, but juvenile court. And then when you get over to factor F, it says the likelihood that the juvenile will develop competency and life skills to become a contributing member of the community by use of the facilities and resources available to the court. And it doesn't say to the juvenile court, but I think that in the context, I think it has to mean that, because otherwise we would be saying, I think that reading it that way harmonizes the whole code, the Juvenile Corrections Act, because we're talking about, let's look at what the juvenile system has available to it. And let's see if that's adequate. And if it is, then let's do that. Of course, subject to these conditions. But but if, or these factors, but I think that that's the, I think that interpretation is supported by the context of it. So that's what I would suggest that that means. Beyond that, I would just reiterate that when this court looks at the magistrate's findings and the comments and things that that were made while making findings and while deciding what to do with my client, I think that as you look at the facts and you compare maybe the degree of the magistrate's conviction about certain things being true, or the necessity of exercising discretion in a certain way, I think that as this court reviews those things and applies the law correctly as it should be interpreted and consistent with the legislative intent and the policy of trying to treat kids like kids if possible, that this court will think differently, I think, about whether there was substantial and competent evidence. I think that as I said in my brief, that there really wasn't on many issues. And I think that if the statute had been interpreted properly, that it would even be less certain. And I would just ask that the court grant our petition and allow my client to be treated as a juvenile. Thank you.
Thank you. The court appreciates the briefing and arguments in this case. The case is now fully submitted and we'll take it under advisement and issue an opinion in due course. Court will be in recess until June 11th.
Thank you.